You are listening to the Library Cafe. Instead of doing our introductory music for Library Cafe today, I thought we would run this little radio play of two people going through an approved B-17 F and G checklist. Pilots pre-flight.
Complete.
Form 1A.
Checked.
Controls and seats.
Checked.
Fuel transfer valves and switch.
Off.
Intercoolers.
Cold.
Gyros.
Uncaged.
Fuel shutoff switches.
Open.
Gear switch.
Neutral.
Cowl flaps, open right, locked.
Open left.
Locked. Turbos.
Off.
Idle cutoff.
Checked.
Throttles.
Closed.
High RPM.
Checked.
Autopilot.
Off.
De-icers and anti-icers.
Off.
Cabin heat.
Off.
Generators.
Off.
Okay, that's all we need to do, right? We're not going to start the engines. You are listening to the Library Cafe. Welcome back after our summer break. I'm thrilled to have back on the show for my first guest of the year, my co-pilot here, Sally Kyle. Sally's here to talk to us about her book, Those Wonderful Women in Their Flying Machines, her narrative history of the WASPs, the Women's Air Service Pilots Corps, first published in 1977 and then revised and expanded in 1990 and published by Four Directions Press. Sally's a writer, a pilot, and a Vassar alumna. Welcome back, Sally.
Thank you, Tom.
So, you know, I'll start just by taking note that I'm really keen to talk to you about this book now, in part because of a number of recent items in the news about the WASPs, including the reinstatement of the right to be buried in Arlington Cemetery in 2016 under President Obama. And I think there was a WASP who was buried right after that.
Elaine Harmon. Yes, that's when she died. That's all she wanted, was to be able to be buried in Arlington Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, no WASP was eligible to be buried there. So that's a whole interesting political story, which we'll get into later in context.
Uh-huh. And then there was this year, this summer, the obituary of your friend Dawn Seymour, who had just celebrated her 100th birthday. And we'll talk about Dawn toward the end of the program. So can you start us off by telling us how you came to write the book? I mean, what inspired you to write it? I know your aunt was a WASP and a B-17 pilot.
Right. It was fun going through a B-17 checklist. She did that every day for 3 months. I grew up knowing that my aunt flew B-17s, mm-hmm. and it was always great fun to tell whoever I was talking to that my aunt flew B-17s. No one could believe it. And she died very suddenly. She was in her mid-50s, and the only memorabilia she had saved were pictures of herself and these women. It was a V formation of young women in these oversized bomber jackets. Mm-hmm. I mean, real bomber jackets, because they were in front of a B-17 bomber, and they were all standing there, and I saw that picture, and I couldn't believe it. I was a journalist in New York City, and when I saw this, I was so inspired just by the looks on their faces in this huge plane. I mean, it's 102 feet wingspan. Mm-hmm. These 13 women in front. So on the back of the picture, she was in the picture, and mm-hmm. she had written the names of her classmates. And mm-hmm. by cross-referencing to a roster, I found, of course, they were their maiden names, of mm-hmm. course, and I found their married names, and I wanted to tell someone that she had died. And mm-hmm. so one of these people, as it turned out, I was in this New York City, lived in Rochester, mm-hmm. and I called her up, and her name was Dawn Rocco Baldwin Seymour. Mm-hmm. And I called her up, and I said, my Aunt Mary has died, and I just wanted someone to know in the WASP organization. And she said, what are you doing this weekend? And so I said, well, I'm coming to Rochester. So I flew to Rochester, and she hosted me for the weekend, and it was astounding, because her children, she had a later marriage, and her children were teenagers, and her son was a football player, and her daughters were cheerleaders, and they skipped practice that Saturday, and we sat around. She pulled out this old trunk mm-hmm. and opened the trunk, and the kids were saying, gee, Mom. She started pulling out uniforms and orders from World War II uh-huh. and pictures of herself in the cockpits of B-17s. Mm-hmm. Her children had not known.
No idea. Oh, that's so interesting.
So that was very enlightening for me.
We grew up in the same era. I mean, our fathers were veterans, and everybody on my block, everybody's father had been in the war in some way or another, including the German kid around the corner whose father had fought for the Germans. Wow. But nobody talked about the war. Men didn't talk about their war experiences. They wanted to put that behind them. I think they may have talked to one another when, you know, the wife and kids weren't around, but they didn't talk about it generally, and they didn't want to talk about it. So we grew up in that era. But it's interesting that these women fell into that same pattern.
It's true. So her children found out what she had done, mm-hmm. and it was pretty remarkable. I persuaded the one woman editor at Esquire magazine that they really should have an article about the women who flew B-17s during World War II.
Yeah. And you were a writer at the time in New York.
I was a journalist, and I thought, this is a great story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Dawn Rocco Baldwin Seymour was quite a person as well. And she had shared her memorabilia with me, you know, her letters and her scrapbooks. So I got the assignment, and I went to Washington to the Air Force History Archives in the Forrestal Building and L'Enfant Plaza. And I told them what I was doing, that I was doing an article on the women who flew B-17s during World War II. And they went back and they brought a pile of old, aging, typed, written reports, you know, maybe a 5-inch pile of them, and they were stamped top secret. Wow. These were reports of the entire program of the Women's Air Force Service pilots.
So now, you didn't have security clearance, of course. So
So I said, well, I look at these? And they said, oh, I'm sure they're declassified by now. Mm-hmm. But in order to do research on this project, there were no books written about it. Mm-hmm. The women, as you say, like the men, they didn't talk about it. Yeah. It was no one totally unknown. Yeah. Everybody knew about the wax and the waves,
yes,
the spars, because they had been officially pulled into the military, and there still were wax and waves.
Yes.
But it was as if the wasps had been lost to history. Uh-huh. I knew about it. The families of the wasps may or may not have known about it. So it was doing research on history that was past. It was in the mists of the past, but the participants still existed.
Still existed. That's so interesting on all kinds of levels, you know, because I interview historians about their work all the time. So, it's interesting that you start doing this as part of your life, as part of notifying friends of your aunt that she had died. So, the beginning of your research process really is part of a correspondence that has to do with your life and your aunt here.
It's
incredibly interesting on that level. And then also, as you say, these people, this is recent history, and it's history that we have an amnesia about. We had an amnesia about for some time. And so, you know, you're working on a historical project, and then you're not an historian either, right? I mean, you weren't until you did this book. Now we'd have to call you an historian, and given the nature of the book and the importance of the book, a brilliant historian, frankly. But you're a journalist, not trained here at Vassar as an historian. I mean, did you take history classes? You probably did.
I did.
Some kind of a background, but
I did, but, you know, for me, history, maybe it's just the way I'm mentally configured, but to me, history is human beings living through their time and doing something remarkable or admirable. Mm-hmm. And we're all human beings. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy reading history I ended up trying to do this in this book, taking individuals, and because there was nothing written about this program, I knew that one of my primary sources was going to have to be interviews with women who participated in it and using their stories. And then, so I had essentially oral history interviews.
Yeah.
It took me 3 years. I had a job in an audiovisual production company, and I would take extended vacations, and I would go to, say, California or the Boston area or someplace and just interview as many of these women as I could. Then I'd come home, and then I'd spend the next 2 or 3 months just transcribing these interviews. And so I had their personal histories. And then I got histories of World War II because I wanted to interweave their experience in with what was going on in the war.
Yes, and your book is partly about that, what's happening with the Army Air Corps and the Air Force, both in this country and in Britain.
Yeah, the reason why women were flying airplanes at all was the tremendous mobilization that was happening long before we got involved in the war. There was lend-lease aircraft to Britain. There was a lot going on the home front. And it was also very clear with the Blitz in London and so on that it was going to be an air war. And prior to World War II...
Not entirely clear to the Navy or the Army at that point, though, right?
They had to scramble. And this is one of the reasons why women got a chance to fly, which brings me into something dear to your heart, too, I think, which is the history of aviation.
Yes, yes. I have to say that I expected, you know, when I started the book, that you'd dive right into the subject matter of the WASPs. But you spent a couple of chapters, at least, laying the groundwork by giving what to me, you know, as an aviation enthusiast, you know, we're both pilots, was just a brilliant narrative account of the first decades of flight, beginning right with the Wright brothers. But of course, you know, that makes sense that the Second World War really begins only 25 years after Kitty Hawk, when you think about
it.
So anyone involved in aviation at this time, including these women, you'd have to regard as pioneers. I mean, these were early flyers, especially at the beginning of the war, flying with something new.
It was a technology, yes.
It's a lovely part of the book, I have to say. It's the most exciting little history of flight I've read.
Well, I will say, a friend of mine, another historian named Rockwell Stensrud, said, you've got to make a choice. If you're going to tell this story, you can decide. You can start with Pearl Harbor, or you can start with the Wright brothers.
Well, it makes sense.
So I figured... Because it was women's history in subject matter, that a lot of my readers might not be pilots.
So you interviewed these women, yes?
Absolutely, face to face.
Very personal sort of history. What was it like to actually meet?
Any interview, you have to get people talking. People love to talk.
Yeah, tell me about it. So, yeah.
I know.
They do, yeah.
So you have to. And these women, since no one had ever asked them about their experience, and they were very modest. They would say, oh, well, that was a long time ago. Gee, it was a great experience. And I would want to get them talking about the details. And so the first thing I would ask was, where did you grow up? And, of course, they were from all over. You know, they were from Oklahoma. They were from eastern Colorado. They were from Minnesota. And then I'd ask, the second question was, how did you get flying? Because in order to join the program, they had to be pilots already. It wasn't like they were accepted for training and then they started training. They had to be pilots already. So these are women who were flying airplanes in the 1930s just because they loved it and because they were so inspired by Amelia Earhart and so inspired. All of them, their dads had taken them out to the local flying field to see the barnstormers. Aviation was new. It was the newest of the newest of the new. And it was a technological innovation that was happening in America, all over, in which women could be as capable as men. There were barriers that were socio-economic, cultural, psychological, perhaps, but women could fly airplanes as well as men.
That's very interesting.
And that was from day one. I mean, the earliest women flying airplanes were, you know, 1911, 1910.
Did you tell me somewhere along the line that the Wright brothers had a sister?
They had a sister, and she was involved in the whole thing. They did a demonstration flight in France, trying to get money, and their promoter, his wife, took an airplane ride. And then there were aviation enthusiasts everywhere. These are gossamer planes.
Yes, they're not much to them. I did an interview with Arthur Groton, a local benefactor to the library here, who gave us a wonderful collection of poster stamps. And many of the poster stamps had to do with early flight because many of these stamps are about the future. You know, they were done at trade shows, that kind of thing. And many of them have to do with the aviation industry. And one of the series that he was just fascinated with, and he got me fascinated, had to do with Harriet Quimby, who was an early aviatrix, or as the pilots call themselves at the time, aeronaut.
Aeronaut. She was an aeronaut.
Wonderful, yeah. A nice word. You know, know, that the FAA still has a lovely word for us. It's on my own pilot's license, and it is airman. You know, I don't know if they have airwomen, but you're probably an airman also.
I'm a certified airman. So aviation was the technological future, mm-hmm. and the airplane itself personified or exemplified modernity.
Our Molly Nesbitt, who I'm going to be interviewing shortly about her book of essays that was just published in Art 105, our big gateway course into art history, devotes one of her lectures on flight. She does the modern part of the curriculum. And she sees the airplane in people like Corbusier and other modernists as a symbol for the essence of what we mean when we say the word modern. And, you know, you have a passage about this that, you know, reads, if many flew to escape the geographical and experiential confines of small-town reality, mastering flight also represented an escape from entrenchment in the past. At that time, flying was considered the most adventurous link to modernity and seemed to assure one's active participation in the decades to come. So that's what you're talking about here, isn't it?
One of the subjects that just infuses the book and infused my experience of doing the book from mm-hmm. the very, very beginning is the word inspiration. Mm-hmm. These young girls growing up in the farmlands of America, mm-hmm. we can barely imagine the inspiration of Amelia Earhart. It's very, very hard. You know, we have superstars today, but yeah. Amelia Earhart was really something. Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh to get in an airplane and fly to Paris or fly to Europe. It just was beyond anyone's imagination. Uh-huh. And when the war loomed and it was clear that it was going to be a war in the air, pilot training programs sprouted up because they needed pilots mm-hmm. and there weren't enough. Uh-huh. We have to understand there's amazing statistics about America, things like under 1% of the American population had been beyond 50 miles of their home where they were born. So you can imagine what the airplane meant.
Yes.
I interviewed a woman who had grown up in Ada, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere, everywhere. And all of the boys she was going to high school with, and they all had their pilot's license, and she decided she wanted to, too. And mm-hmm. her father finally agreed and eventually bought her an airplane. Mm-hmm. And all the boys went off to college, and this college was 500 miles away. Mm-hmm. And she was invited to a dance. So her dad said, well, why don't you take the plane? And so she hopped into her plane and headed, followed the railroad tracks to this college to meet with her date. Uh-huh. And the light was going, and she looked down, and here were these four bonfires at the corners of a cow field. Mm-hmm. And that's where she landed. And all the guys came up and cheering, and they were all excited because this girl had flown herself to the dance.
That's quite amazing.
But that's who they were. That's who these girls, the girls and later women who flew B-17s and P-51s.
So they were inspired by people like Amelia Earhart and Harriet Quimby also, who's very famous flyer that we don't know much about anymore.
She died into Boston Harbor.
Yeah, and it was a national tragedy when she did, and this was in the first decade of flight. It's very early, so glamorous individual she was. So one of the interesting things you do in this book as a narrative device, I have to say, I was just completely taken with it as a reader of history, and I know this is history where you're actually interviewing people who lived through it, but even so, rather astonishing thing you do that I can't recall encountering elsewhere is that you fold individual names and stories about these women who were in the Women's Air Service pilots. You fold into their stories these early accounts of flight. So where these individuals cross paths with Amelia Earhart, say, or at least you've even read about Amelia Earhart.
A couple of the women did see Earhart. These are girls who hung out at the local airports washing airplanes, just like their brothers.
Yeah. So you have, you know, Edith Berg, Marianne Hanahan, Betty Taylor, Dolores Murin. They all figure early on in your narrative when you're just talking about the history of flight, and then they pop up later.
When I asked them what got you interested in flying, they started talking about being, you know, 8 years old and taking a Barnstormer flight. Yeah. And I mean, they were interested in flying very, very young, and they just followed right along.
And Jacqueline Cochran herself appears early in the narrative, doesn't she? The great hero of your book, really, she is, who formed the Women's Air Service Pilots Corps. You know,
she was an air race pilot. There was a lot of promotion of aviation going on in the 30s, and there were air races, and they were trying to fly faster, longer, and they were experimenting with fuel tank capacities and so on. And Cochran, Earhart, was kind of a romantic figure.
Early pioneer.
Early pioneer. And Cochran, she was a real aviatrix. She was a competitor. She had her own cosmetics company. She was a CEO type.
Yeah, rather impoverished beginning she had, didn't she? She was an orphan.
Well, she's a very interesting character.
She is.
There's a lot to be researched about Jacqueline Cochran. There's now been a biography of her.
She figures so prominently in the book. I mean, this is like a reading a history of the French Revolution, and you come across a figure like Napoleon Bonaparte. You
know, she strikes me like that. So, yes, she's a fascinating woman. She was in her mid-30s at this point, and she had won all these air races, and she could talk with the tough guys. She could persuade the generals. It wasn't easy, but she had the chutzpah and the attractiveness and the determination to do that. And she persuaded
Hap Arnold, among others,
Exactly. She persuaded the commanding general of the Army Air Forces, Hap Arnold, in the Pentagon, to form a group of women. Now, in the beginning of the war, when manpower, human power, was so important, women went to work everywhere. We know that. And in the military, there were a lot of jobs that the generals realized could be done by women. And so the WACs were formed, and the WAVES of the Navy. Now, they were civilians, and the SPARs were the Marines. And they eventually were brought formally into the military operation and given
commission.
After the
war, they got veterans benefits, including
GI Bill.
The GI Bill,
That's right.
And if they were killed in action, they got a funeral. I mean, they didn't have to pay for their own funerals. They didn't have to pay for their own way back and forth from home after the war.
I know. So Jacqueline Cochran got the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, the WASPs, formed on that basis.
But the WASPs weren't militarized, however, were they? No.
They weren't. Cochran was such a visionary and so, I would say, aggressive in the the best possible way. Effective is what she was. There were 25,000 women who applied to her program. Now, they had to have flying hours already.
You and I know how hard those are to log, even in this day and age.
Oh, they are.
They're expensive. And,
I know. My aunt, for instance, was teaching physical education in upstate New York, and she had a beau who had a plane, and he was drafted, and he flew his airplane to Mississippi to his base. And she took the train down and flew his airplane while he was training. Now, this was, in a way, scandalous, but she wanted to get her hours up so she could apply for the WASP. And all the women did something to get their hours in. But Cochran, at General Arnold's side, which is amazing in itself, she got her corps of women assigned throughout the entire air training endeavor enterprise in America. And she had women, this is what the WASPs ended up doing. They ferried planes from the aircraft manufacturers to the ports of embarkation where they were put on ships
and moved and to Europe or
sent
the, or
to
the
England
theater,
or to Japan. So these were new airplanes fresh off the assembly line, and so that they were essentially test pilots for these individual aircraft. A lot of them didn't have the right instruments in them yet, and
And that was before they were actually hired as test pilots. So I mean,
these were
individual
civil
aircraft
service.
These are shakeout flights, basically.
They were extensively used in the training of Gunners, and navigators. And I wanted to read something.
And I should say this is a beautifully written book. I mean, just beautifully. It's a work of art. I'm astonished that it didn't get the New York Times bestseller list for best nonfiction book and didn't stay up there for a long time. If not a Pulitzer, honestly, Sally, it really is a beautiful thing.
So, well, I'm glad. This is a woman named Marion Hanrahan, and I interviewed her. She was stationed at one of the largest, possibly the largest, gunnery training base. Mm-hmm. And it was along the coastline of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And these are guns along the beachhead.
So, you know, you're talking about training anti-aircraft gunners.
That's right.
Who are ground-based anti-aircraft gunners, but also training gunners that would fly in a bomber aircraft, in a turrets and waste gunners.
The crews who went to Europe were very well trained.
Yes. Yeah.
And the women flew the airplanes in which they trained.
Yeah.
That's what it is. So, here we go. This is gunnery training. Mm-hmm. Marion looked down the beachhead. Extending for about a mile were positions for batteries of anti-aircraft guns. At one end of the beach were the 3-inch guns, then 40 and 35 millimeter guns, and finally, down at the end, small arms trainees with rifles. She would start at one end and fly at the altitude given her by the gunnery officer. Then she got to the small arms range, and she would fly down lower to give them shots at the target.
The targets are sleeves that come out on the back of the
muslin
aircraft.
Sleeves. Down the beach, the gunners had received instruction to take enough lead on the target before they fired to compensate for the lack of maneuverability of the large and lumbering gun barrels pointing 15 to 20 feet into the air. Unlike the guns in the ball turrets of B-17s, which tracked attacking fighters, ground-based anti-aircraft guns swiveled clumsily in their casing. Often, by the time a gunner could get a target in sight and shoot, the plane had flown on ahead of his line of fire. As Marion began her flight along the beach high above the gun emplacements, the officers walked up and down behind the gunners, bellowing, "More lead, more lead." Marion began to hear thudding explosions that seemed to reverberate in her chest. She felt a thrill, both excitement and alarm, as she clasped the stick of the A-24 and kept the plane at altitude. "So this is what it's like to fly in combat," she thought. Then the Dauntless started to bump in the air, and the explosions came louder. As she looked out the windscreen, she saw black tufts dangling in the air around her plane. An instant later, she heard her cable operator in the back shout, "Jesus, that's flak! Tell those SOBs to take a lead on the sleeve, not the plane." Marion radioed the gunnery officers that there was flak awfully near her engine cowling. In 30 seconds, the bumping on the airplane stopped. Marion then realized what she had just flown through. The anti-aircraft command motto was, "Keep 'em falling." She wondered whose side they thought she was on, or just how good or bad these gunners really were.
So funny.
That's from an interview.
Uh-huh.
This is what you can do
I see.
From an interview. Yeah. You can really make a narrative.
You can hear the voices of these women.
I channeled them, I think.
Yeah. So let me jump back just briefly. When we were talking about the early years of flight, we were talking about Amelia Earhart. You will really relate this wonderful story about her taking Eleanor Roosevelt up over Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Something that those of us who live around Hyde Park and Eleanor's estate at Valkillen and the FDR house at Hyde Park find especially interesting, I think. So Amelia and Eleanor went for a ride in an airplane?
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt, you talk about an inspiration. She was an amazing inspiration. She and Earhart were friends, and I have this passage. In April 1933, Earhart and her husband, George Palmer Putnam, were invited as dinner guests of the Franklin Delano Roosevelts, newly arrived in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
After dinner, Earhart and Eleanor Roosevelt chatted about flying. Earhart was extolling the beauty of flying at night, how the world becomes serene and glittering far above the lighted outlines of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Roosevelt seemed so enthralled that Earhart, with characteristic forthright spontaneity, asked if she would like to take a flight. "Now?" asked Eleanor Roosevelt. "Why not?"
Mm-hmm.
asked her dinner companion.
Mm-hmm.
Without telling their husbands, they grabbed a delighted woman reporter, slipped out of the White House, and commandeered a limousine which sped them to National Airport, where Earhart arranged to borrow an Eastern Airlines plane.
Mm-hmm.
Still wearing her white kid gloves, the First Lady of the Air took off and flew the First Lady of the Nation up over the Potomac and Tidal Basin and into the clear night sky over Washington, D.C., for Mrs. Roosevelt's first view of the glittering Capitol from the air. When they landed back at the airport, Eleanor Roosevelt was so delighted by the sensation that she asked Earhart if she would teach her how to fly. Much to the disappointment of the two women, the president vetoed the whole idea. But Mrs. Roosevelt's interest in faith in women and aviation did not wane. She became their champion when, with the advent of war in Europe, women were officially overlooked by her husband's military advisors as they mobilized America's air-trained population.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You know, the interesting thing about all of us, to me, the WASPs, the whole summary of their contribution here, and individuals like Earhart and Cochrane, is they are bona fide heroes, the way we think of heroes, like Lindbergh, you know, it's a nice comparison here. But they really made a contribution to who we are as a people and as human beings. And Jacqueline Cochrane, no less than Amelia Earhart in her own way. I mean, I know she was a racer, but she also made other contributions also. And her story kind of starts, we were talking about Hyde Park. I mentioned Hyde Park. Her story kind of starts in Hyde Park because she had Roosevelt's ear, yes,
early
on.
Did.
Yeah, so FDR's
ear,
yeah.
Anybody's ear who yeah, she could get to.
So she visited Roosevelt in Hyde Park to pitch her idea of having women ferry military aircraft throughout the country and her idea to start up a women's air corps, yes?
She wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And it took a while. First, she had to take women to England.
Uh-huh. Yes.
England, of course, was mobilized to the nth degree.
Yeah, yeah,
and
if the motto here is necessity is the mother of invention, it could be the motto of the WASPs in some ways. I mean, women were needed in this capacity. Flyers were needed, certainly, and women were flyers. And there weren't enough men flyers, trained flyers. But in England, the stakes were higher, and their backs were really against the wall, and the air war was, you know, the Battle of Britain
was
extremely important to their survival, wasn't it? So the British had no problem, did they?
No problem whatsoever.
Drafting women into the military to fly military aircraft in wartime, not as combat pilots, but as service pilots. Yes.
Right.
So.
But I had the extreme pleasure of interviewing a woman who flew with Cochrane over there, and her name is Emily Chapin. So I was able to do a whole chapter about Emily and her experience in England.
Uh-huh. Yes,
she ended up flying Spitfires.
Yes. Yeah.
And mind you, they had no instruments, and they were having to fly to airfields, and they would have to circle the airfield while they'll pull down the barrage balloons.
Uh-huh.
Then they could land, then they put the barrage balloons back up, because everything was on.
Instruments hadn't been loaded on a plane yet, because flying in Old Blighty, where it's foggy all the time, and cloudy all the time, I can't imagine. You know?
I know. And a woman was killed, flying into the... They flew into a mountain.
And these were Americans then flying with the British early on.
That's
because I know there were American combat pilots that signed up with the RAF, but these were American women that were flying with the
air transport. It was called the Air Transport Auxiliary.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting chapter because they were a model, weren't they, for Cochrane to some extent?
They were. And then Cochrane was able to come back to America. Then it was very clear that there were a lot of things women could do in the air to, quote unquote, free up men for combat.
Yeah.
But, you know, in America, only one service person in seven saw combat during World War II.
Yes.
People don't realize that.
No, most not. My father
there was
in the quartermaster corps.
There we go.
Yes.
There was so much mobilization to train, to produce a combat-ready troop.
The other unknown here, interestingly, is that these women didn't fly in combat areas. However, that doesn't guarantee that flying wasn't dangerous for them, because these aircraft tended to be dangerous just to take them up and put them down again, didn't they?
Right.
And I know for the Pacific Theater, there's a statistic that will tell you that more American pilots died in accidents or being lost at sea, you know, without being able to navigate back to base, in accidents that were actually killed, you know, by being shot down in combat. And even outside of the Pacific Theater, huge numbers of pilots were lost, training and other kinds of flying that weren't combat flying, weren't they? So these women did have to worry about that, didn't they? I mean, this was a dangerous world.
Well, 38 died.
38
crashed to their deaths, and an equal number were injured, survived, but were injured. And they were only civil service, so they didn't they didn't get the gold star from the families.
No, they didn't get the funerals paid for, did they?
If they had to take a collection, send the body home.
Yeah.
So you said that your uncle was a pilot during World War II
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, my Uncle Jim, my mother's brother, was a Marine pilot in the Pacific, yes. It was lucky for him. I mean, it was who he was. We all knew him as having been a pilot, and he continued to fly when he was a civilian afterwards. But he was a Marine pilot, a Corsair pilot in the Second World War. And then he re-upped or came in as a reservist in the Korean War and also flew Corsairs. When there were big jets flying around as an air-to-ground Corsair pilot again, flying off Jeep carriers, which were these, you know, little service carriers that were basically not built to be aircraft carriers. They were trawlers and merchant ships that had decks put on them. And, you know, Corsair itself didn't land easily, even on a full-blown fast carrier, let alone these little Jeep carriers. That was a very dangerous occupation, and he did crash on landing once he went off the deck and into the soup and had to be pulled out of the plane. So
I don't know. Yeah. Our lives are very different nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
We were lucky then. I think that this is kind of an aside,
mm-hmm.
but my aunt was such an inspiration to me. Mm. I think it's very important that we focus in on what people of the prior generation did. They were part of history from our point of view. They were part of history, and they have specific memories of that time. Say if your mom was involved with the women's movement in the 70s, or your grandparents, what were they involved in? It's so fascinating to have a personal account of what to you is history. I just encourage anybody to do an oral history of people who inspired you.
Yeah, which is what you've done here. It's oral-based history, isn't it?
So. Well, I ended up doing that because my aunt died before I really got a chance to ask her all these details, and boy, I got a book out of it.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. You know, the thing is, we all had a sense when we were children that fathers had come back from the war and something had been accomplished. And, you know, there was a wonderful sense in the United States at that time that we were capable and open-handed people. I mean, this was the end of the Roosevelt administration. And even then, I grew up in the Kennedy years. There was some legacy of that. It was a very heroic time, in a way, for this country. You know, the greatest generation, I don't know, but mm-hmm. there is that. But, you know, the interesting thing about these women is they didn't get any credit for what they did here. Does the ordinary person know the name Jacqueline Cochran? No, I wouldn't think so. These women, they just came home, and they knew what they had done. They knew they had made a contribution. This was to Cochran and everybody else about making that contribution. It wasn't about glory. So it's not as though they asked for that, nor while they were doing the job did they ask for any quarter or special dispensation. They wanted to be recognized for what they'd done. And it would have been nice if we'd given them veterans' benefits.
I have a chapter in my book called The Battle of the Wasps.
Uh-huh, yes.
Tongue-in-cheek a little bit. But in 1944, the way the Wacks and the Waves had been militarized, Jacqueline Cochran decided, okay, now look, we've got to militarize these women. They're flying officers and everything but name. They don't have insurance. They don't get on board
here. And they were getting treated terribly oftentimes on the bases that they would land on by the commanders of those bases and the people on those bases, weren't they?
There was a lot of incomprehension.
Thrown in jail sometimes,
I know.
So yes,
They were thrown in jail and landed in Georgia. Yeah, there's some amazing stories.
Yeah.
But I think this is a really, really interesting political science case for somebody, a thesis, a paper at least, to see the legislative history of the Women's Air Force Service pilots.
Uh-huh.
1944, they decided, Jacqueline Cochran and Hep Arnold decided the best way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It was a top secret program.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been denigrating to our preparedness image for the world to know that there were women flying airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the top secret.
And from our point of view, the British had no problem with it, though, did they?
They were too under fire.
Yes, yeah, I think so, yes.
But in America, that wasn't accepted.
Nor did the Russians.
Yeah, that's right.
They had combat pilots.
Yeah, I know. So what they decided to do was keep it very, very quiet and just say, Hap Arnold wants this program, and we're going to militarize them, and we're just going to push this bill through Congress and just kind of sneak it in a way, because the commanding general of the Army Air Forces wanted it, and that was it. There wasn't a big hearing. There wasn't anything like that. This is what he wanted, and it was rubber stamped, basically, with Congress. Well, that didn't work out too well because the media got hold of the whole idea that women were flying airplanes and men should be doing those jobs, and the bill was defeated by 19 votes. So within weeks, they disbanded the program, and the women went home, paid their own way home, and I know from my interviews it was very, very hard on some of them. It was too much. You're in the cockpit of a P-51 or a B-26 or a B-17, and the next day you're on the train home to your hometown. Yeah. It was very hard for some of them.
Some committed suicide.
There was one I know of. And, I mean, they had real trouble. I mean, it was hard for the men, too, to readjust to civilian life.
And there was competition, wasn't there? Because toward the end of the war, when there was a surplus of pilots...
Yeah, the men came home and wanted the women's jobs. They,
yeah, you know, one story that you tell there of the pilots being incredibly boorish to a group of WASPs who were in a hotel there. And, it's really rather, rather sad. And then they lobbied against, of course, the civil air pilots lobbied against. And, of course, the American Legion showed its ugly head. They lobbied against the WASPs here very heavily, didn't they? So,
well, 30 years after they were all sent home in 1944, this was fun for me because here I was writing a book and suddenly... The WASPs organized and introduced a bill in Congress to give them retroactive World War II veteran status. So you had 1944, that congressional morass, and then 1977.
Yeah.
And that was a whole new...
Where, again, the American Legion showed its ugly heads.
It was the same guys. It was the really odd.
You had a champion then. Strange to say, in Barry Goldwater, who was a pilot,
high-time pilot.
So, thank you,
and
Barry.
Thank you, Barry. Yeah, and that was the bill to provide veteran status for the Women's Air Force Service pilots. It was the first and possibly the only legislation. I'm not sure. I'm not a political scientist, but it was the first piece of legislation ever co-sponsored by all the women members of Congress. Who, of course, spanned the spectrum politically, but all the women members of Congress got behind this bill. And it also took advantage of the 70s feminist climate because it was during the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And they were really trying to appoint women all throughout his government, and all of them got together behind the Women's Air Force Service pilots. So you had 800 women, I tell you, they're in their 60s, scattered all over the country, and they mobilized all these women in Washington to back them. So
the difficulty
that bill had going through Congress.
So what was at stake here? I mean, they didn't have to buy houses and raise families and go to college as they would have done early on with the GI bills.
It was medical benefits.
Most
of the WASP, they were very, very smart, like the men pilots in World War II. They passed incredible.
They had to be. Jacqueline Cochran
made
sure that
they
were as good or better
smart.
Than.
Absolutely. And
they had to adhere to the same or better standards than the men, both physically and mentally and as flyers.
So most of them in life had done very well. So, you know, it wasn't a real drain on the veterans' budget, but, they were assaulted.
Well, that's great.
So that's a fascinating story. And then there was another round just recently when Elaine Harmon wanted to be buried in Arlington Cemetery. And here again, they had to, the women members of Congress rallied on their behalf, and there was all this opposition. It's a fascinating case study. So if anybody wants information, they can call me.
So apart from Cochran, there was Nancy Love, a Vassar graduate.
And that's right.
She had her own little core of flyers also, So Cochran wasn't the only person pressing for women to be able to play a part in the war effort, for women flyers, right?
Nancy Harkness Love went to Vassar, and she mobilized a group. There were, you know, maybe a couple dozen only, and they all had 500,000, 2,000 hours in the air. They were very, very experienced. And the Air Transport Command was the organization they flew for. And they were called Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron, WAFS. And they flew throughout the war. And when Cochran organized the WASP, they were incorporated in. But they were aristocrats, women aristocrats of the air. And, it, of course, the first thing that happened, here are these women with 2,000 hours in the air. They were just to see if women could do it. They were all put in little Piper Cubs, flying all over the open cockpit Piper Cubs.
Yeah, the kind of humiliation that both Cochran's and Love's people had to go through getting into the system was something, wasn't it? Well, the medical tests, right? There was a question about menstruation, you know, and if this is going to disqualify women from flying at all.
It's an amazing story.
But interestingly, as Cochran was able to prove, these women made better pilots on average than your average male pilot, yes? I mean, in terms of being able to fly, in terms of the record, crash record, what they were able to do with the jobs that were given them, often jobs that the men were afraid to do, like towing targets and also doing the kind of test pilot work that had to be done, not just flying new models of airplanes, which is kind of glamorous, and a woman did fly actually one of the first jets, yes?
That's true.
But also test pilots, meaning, you know, when you have these aircraft that have been redlined and were ready for the scrap heap that were put back together by mechanics, they had to be taken out and shaken down again. Mm-hmm. And that was incredibly dangerous work because the airplanes half the time wouldn't be repaired, yes? So so these women would do that kind of work, and they were really good at it, weren't they?
They take on were anything, determined yes, to do a good job. Yeah, one of them said, now look, honey, I wasn't a feminist. I just wanted to fly those airplanes. You know, they weren't.
So funny,
They weren't political, and they weren't out for glory.
That must have been interesting to interview them. And they all came through the same place in Sweetwater, Texas. Avenger Field, a.k.a. Cochran's Convent.
Avenger Field,
that must have been something.
And there's now a museum there. No, there was nothing there. There was nothing. Now there's a wonderful museum.
I've been through it driving, you know, from Dallas Airport to my parents' place in Roswell, New Mexico, out 20. So it's out Route 20. West of Fort Worth, a couple of hours, as I remember, but it's in the middle of nowhere, not honestly
Texas.
In a very pleasant part of Texas. So.
A lot of sky.
Yeah, a lot of sky.
There were a lot of training bases out there, and as a matter of fact, when Cochran first got Avenger Field for the women, there were a lot of quote-unquote forced landings, at which point Cochran ordered the training command not to let anybody onto Avenger Field under any circumstances, and then it got the reputation as being Cochran's Convent.
Oh, I see, because they didn't want male pilots flying in there
and they did.
Landing, and they did, yes. And that was another kind of handicap for them, however, wasn't it? In that they had to be nuns in a sense, didn't they? Because there was a reputation there that they had to uphold, and the whole thing could have been squelched if it had been felt that there was some kind of anything going on here that was not above board, right?
Yeah. And it had to be top secret in any case for the war.
However, you do have accounts, not personal accounts so much, that women are women and men are men, and there was some fraternization, wonderful accounts of what might go on in the nose of a B-17.
This is true. Yeah. I interviewed a woman who married a B-17 pilot. Actually, he was already a graduate, and he was flying in the war. It was the first on record marriage of two B-17 pilots, and my friend Don Rocco, Don Rocco Baldwin Seymour, who just died at age 100, she flew B-17s with my aunt, and she was stationed down in Florida at a gunnery training base, and she met her first husband there, and he was killed in the war.
People I've known that have flown down there always talk about how beautiful the sky is there and the wonderful clouds over it, because we just had the hurricane there. But did you tell me you learned to fly in Florida?
One of my first interviews was out in California, and I was meeting my interviewee. She had a small flight school, and it was one of the little airports all over. They're scattered around L.A., and I showed up, and she had corralled two of her WASP friends. And I didn't expect to meet them. And she says, come on, girl, we're going flying. So here, you know, when you start a book, you never know what you're going to get into.
But I can see this is a wonderful idea and very important for you to learn to fly to be able to write this book. Because it gives you so much background about what these women are talking about when they talk about flying. Yes,
I climbed into a little Piper Cherokee with these three women with their clouds of white hair, and we took off over L.A., and they were whooping and screaming and having such a fantastic time, and I said, I am not going to be able to understand these people unless I fly. I have to learn how to fly. Yeah. So here again, my next vacation, I went to Florida where my parents were living, and I flew every day for 3 weeks. I mean, it was far from the training
that they
got for 6 months in Sweetwater, Texas, but I did get the feeling of flying every day, every day, every day.
Most trainees don't get that. I mean, civilians, I didn't. I mean, once or twice a week over a period of years,
I just spent a lot of money and just really flew. And I was able to solo, and I used to think that everybody should solo an airplane just because it's such an amazing experience to just have your instructor get out and you just put the throttle forward and you just go. It's an amazing thing. Yeah.
So what did you like most about flying?
Me?
Yes.
I'd say the cross-country, you know, the planning, the charts,
sectionals,
you know, getting sectionals you get, and you plan your trip. Then you're actually up there, and you're, of course, and you're flying in Florida. You're looking down, and the chart says, check. You know, and you're flying along the canals. But the women who flew P-51s were manufactured in California, and they would have to fly them all across the country.
Yeah, can you imagine flying an aircraft that flies 500 miles an hour?
It took them a while to get
you covered.
That's
you know,
right. Yeah. Took them a while to keep up with their charts.
A whole sectional chart every 10 minutes or so.
One of the women who was a B-51 pilot said, "Oh, honey, it was so wonderful. Getting into a P-51 was just like putting on a kid glove."
Well, the planes these women flew, they flew almost everything that was produced, didn't they, in
everything.
This country?
There was one plane they couldn't fly, and that was the
B-24.
B-24, because it didn't have hydraulics.
Yes, yeah.
And but the B-29.
Some fear that they wouldn't be physically strong enough to handle the aircraft if a couple of engines went up.
But the B-29, the men were refusing to fly it. Uh-huh. It was so huge to them. Uh-huh. And so.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Cochrane and Arnold. They said, well, we know what to do. Yeah. So they trained two women, two of the WASPs, in the B-29.
Yeah, and then they were some of the first B-29 pilots.
Yeah, they were.
To fly the airplane.
They were. Yeah. And they flew, these two women flew the B-29 into these air bases and just kind of got out of the cockpit and walked out. And the guys had to fly them. I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, there was a way shaming the male pilots.
Galvanizing them.
Yeah, galvanizing, yeah. But also Cochrane did the same thing, didn't she?
In the B-26.
And also B-17, flying them to England because they were afraid to,
that
kind of ocean flight. And Cochrane, being a racer and a long-distance racer, was really good, wasn't she, at navigation over long periods of time on instruments. Mm-hmm. So she and the people she trained were able to fly across the Atlantic.
The women wanted to fly.
Yeah, they wanted to fly, yes.
But Arnold didn't want women to be flying into his bases with combat-ready troops.
Yeah, routinely,
he didn't know. He didn't think that was such a good idea.
Yeah,
We've come a long way.
Yeah, and then there were other aircraft, difficult aircraft, like the P-39, for instance, where the engine was mounted behind. The song used to go, "Don't give me a P-39 with the engine mounted behind. It'll tumble and roll and dig a deep hole. Don't give me a P-39. And, you know, the problem with the P-39 is that it stalled very easily because of the placement of the engine. Yes, so, but Cochrane's people were happy to fly them. And
I know they flew a lot of P-39s.
And you write that they actually saved a lot of lives because they learned that you have to land the plane a little hot, a little fast, and that will save you from stalling on landing, right? And then the B-26 also, a plane almost impossible to fly by all accounts, but they managed to fly it very well without a lot of accidents, yes.
Yeah. The guys called it the flying prostitute because it seemed to have no visible means of support. Now that's World War II humor.
Well, the wings.
But they trained a whole lot of women in it. So I guess there is some certain galvanizing that went on.
So they flew the huge bombers like the B-29 and the B-17s, and they also flew all the fighters, including the P-47, which looks, if you've ever seen one, it looks like a flying engine. You know, there's more column engine and propeller than there is anything else. It also had short wings, fairly short wings.
My friend Dawn, who recently took her last flight, she did an interview with NPR's The Moth. That, I mean, this interview gives you almost the experience that I had interviewing them. Now, she's 97, mind you, but oh my goodness, she lectured quite a lot.
Yeah, so I'll link that to the site on the Library Cafe at library-cafe.org. I'll place it under the listen link for your interview here. Her description of what it was like to fly for the first time, too, is just lovely there. So.
It is. That'll give you a perfect idea of who Dawn was and all these women. They were so fantastic to interview. They inspired me forever.
So in 2010, the unit was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. I've posed this question to our friend Eve Dombra, who, as we're doing this interview here upstairs in the Taylor Hall of my office, is down in 102 Taylor lecturing on the Nike of Sabbath race, the winged victory.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect.
So anyway, I asked this to her when I interviewed her about her history of her book called Roman Women. I asked her about her motivation in doing the book, because there's some passages that are very sweet, especially when she's talking about the little dolls of Roman girls that were discovered in coffins and who these girls might have been and what these dolls might have meant to them. But also a lot of the women she talks about, she works from funerary sites, so gravestones. Basically, so we know the names of these Roman women, and we know something about them. The question that I put to her about her motivation, if she had a personal motivation for bringing the stories of these women to light, and I prefaced it with a statement that I sometimes put to historians. It's a quote from a French historian and historiographer, Jules Michelet, or a French major, so you know Michelet well, that he wanted, he said, to write his history of the French Revolution because he had breathed in the dust, as he put it, of the citizens who had gone before him, to whom the French people owed so much, and he felt he owed so much, and that they had been living people, and he felt that their actual physical dust was right in the French National Archives, which he had worked in there. And so, in his history, so I get this feeling that you're doing the same thing. You met these women, yes? So can you talk to me about what it means to write this kind of history, where you are bringing into the historical record the stories of living people?
Well, happily, they weren't dust when I
was interviewing them,
but they are now. And so it's a wonderful question you're asking, because now they really are. I mean, the Congressional Gold Medal, that isn't given to everybody. It's a very special thing, and it was a wonderful, wonderful event to go to. Some of these, I was there because of my aunt. I represented my aunt. So a family member was invited to come, and I went with my cousin, and it was an amazing thing, because here are these women. I mean, they were wearing their uniforms. Now, these are women now who are in their 80s. Yeah. They were in their uniforms.
And they had such a hard time getting those uniforms originally, because they didn't have uniforms to start with, did they?
No, they were wearing men's things.
But so were these uniforms designed by Jacqueline Cochran, who's
they
a fashion designer?
Mayne Bacher. Yeah. They were, she made sure that they were handsome uniforms. And they're not how household word even now, but there are a lot more people who know about the WASPs now, and there's the WASP museums, there are all kinds of things on the internet now about them. So
I'm very, very, very happy. That will come out, Your book, I have to say, would make a great base for a screenplay. And there was a film, wasn't there, with Loretta Young that was done
during
in the 40s.
War. Exactly. So. And I just heard of a play being produced in Tampa about the WASPs. Yeah. So
the other thing this would make a good base for is a Ken Burns type treatment, where you really did a kind of documentary history with voices. I don't know if you saved the recordings.
There are a lot of recordings. There's a whole archive in Texas at the Texas Women's University, and that has been the official archives for the women pilots.
Having their voices in.
There are a lot of oral histories in that now.
Contact Ken Burns. Okay, so I'd like to thank you, Sally, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Those Wonderful Women and Their Flying Machines, and the History of the WASPs.
I enjoyed every minute of it.
Me too. It was wonderful to talk. We'll look forward to talking to you about your next book on on the Minoans. So I know you take a little time to write your books, but I hope to still be here doing my show. So, okay, well, thank you, Sally.
Thank you.